Scene 18, Henrietta Corvus, 7:45 p.m. The party was crowded, filling two large rooms with a corridor in between. It was not as though the people were stationary and I could simply go from group to group studying the faces. They were moving around, brushing past me, shifting and changing, nor was it as though I were invisible and could carry on my errand undisturbed. I knew perhaps one out of 10 people there, and each one, it seemed to me, hailed me. I was a celebrity, getting more mileage out of the fact that I had found the body than out of all 4 1/5 in press of my books put together. There wasn't, as far as I could see, any diminution of gaiety at the party from what might have been expected if all were well. There was no trace of solemnity over and above that which might have resulted from a momentary difficulty in getting to the bar, or from a conversation that might have come to rest for a while on the matter of the loss of a job, of a book, of a buck. Life goes on. Here was the case of a man who some 9 hours before had been one of the stars of the convention, and some 6 or 7 hours before he had met with death, violent and unexpected. It was a pity, it was a shame, it was a shock, it was terrible, and then life went on. Giles was swallowed up by the inexorable advance of time, and it was as though he had never been. Here's to the next man who dies. And if it had been someone else who found the body, if I had been in no way involved, if I had not been late with the package of pens, would I have been any different? I didn't have to make any bets with myself. It was a dead certainty that I would have been no different. Life goes on. If every human being on earth were to die in one gory moment, whatever else of life on the planet was left would go on, unconcerned, and nothing else in the entire universe would give a damn. Nor should they. The universe goes on. I was getting more and more morbid as I went from group to group, being engaged at times and disengaging myself at times, and coming to the decision that the needle I was hunting for wasn't there, and thinking I would see her tomorrow anyway. And then, about 7:45, I heard her voice. I didn't see her at first. I turned in the direction of her voice, and with that as guide, I recognized her at once. I joined the group quietly and listened, trying to work myself in temporarily as a member. I wanted to abstract her from the group, and I didn't want to do it very ostentatiously. Being unobtrusive is easier for me than for most. I don't take up much room. And I'm not one of those noticeable characters, either for reasons of sheer bulk, as Giles had been, or out of a visible glow of self-satisfaction, as Asimov is. When I had been standing there long enough to be taken for granted, I managed to lock eyes with Henrietta. Recognition on her part was instantaneous, but after a second or two, she looked away, quite deliberately. I nudged my way next to her and tapped her very lightly on the elbow. When she turned, I said, "I want to talk to you." I mouthed it so that I practically made no sound. She said, "Why?" talking normally. I said, still quite low, "It's important." About... She didn't finish the phrase, not because I interrupted her or because anyone or anything did. She just didn't want to finish it, and that gap in sound was as clear an ending to the phrase as a word would have been. "Yes. Can't it wait?" She was looking angry. "Please," I said. She looked rapidly from face to face as though hoping for some sort of rescue, but her momentary withdrawal from the general conversation meant merely that it flowed past and over her, and it was as though she were not there at all. So she said crossly, "Well, not here, please, come with me." I've felt reluctant arms in my time. I've led girls in directions they were not sure they wanted to go. Generally, I expected to be able to change their minds and make them glad they had come along. This time it was different. Henrietta's arm felt stiff and unyielding, and I didn't have the self-assurance of delights to come to lend me plausibility. I said, "Let's go outside. We can't talk here. Just outside. 5 steps outside," I said urgently. "No more." She came with me. It was the darker half of twilight outside, with the sky slate-gray and the air motionless and mild. The traffic was gaudy in its headlights and tail-lights. The street was wide, not too full of people, and there was a hip-high wall of concrete about the building in which the restaurant was. Through a break in the wall, there was a wide, shallow stairway that led down to a sunken patio. It had been my notion to go down to the patio, but it carried an overflow of people from the party at the small tables there, so I motioned her instead to sit down on the wall. I placed my hands on it and lifted myself up to sit on it with my feet dangling. She said, "That was a terrible thing. Talk about the wrong kind of publicity. It will be in all the papers." "I don't know about that, Henrietta. The hotel will do its best to keep it quiet. And what is there to a guy falling in the tub? He's not exactly a household word. He might become one after this, but he isn't yet." I was trying to soothe her, loosen her up. I swung my feet and grew chattier. "You know," I said, "when the movie actor James Dean died in a road accident about 20 years ago, he got exactly 2 inches in the newspapers. I noticed it at the time because I had seen him on a TV show and had admired him. Then his final movies came out, and he became a soaring teenage idol. If 2 years after his death he could have come back to life and died again, there'd have been no type large enough for any newspaper in the United States to announce the fact. It might be that way with Giles 2 years from now, but right now it's 2 inches, maybe 1 inch. It might be that way with Giles 2 years from now, but right now it's 2 inches, maybe 1 inch. I'm the one who had to make the announcement. It's your job. It doesn't mean I have to like it. All right, don't like it. What you're doing is disliking me, just because I brought the news to you. I don't like it either. How'd you have liked to have been there and... Shut up! Rather to my surprise, she seemed on the point of tears. I did shut up, and waited till I saw whether she was going to tip toward tears or dry eyes. It was the latter, and she said, "What are we doing out here?" I said, "Look, he was a friend of mine. You were there last night, and he didn't want to go with you, remember? I made him go, and because I did, he couldn't pick up a package he wanted to pick up, and he asked me to do so, and I didn't get a chance to do it. It's important to me now to make sure that my failure with that package didn't lead to his death. This could mean a lot to me. Just remember that I'm stuck with my misery now because I did you a favor last night. I'm trying to find out as much about this whole thing as I can now, and you can return the favor and help me." She wasn't buying it, though I was using my most sincere and insinuating tone of voice. She said, "How could the package mean anything one way or the other?" I shrugged. "They were pens. He always used monogrammed pens, and he had left his supply home. I didn't get them to him, so he autographed books with the one pen he had, and it ran out of ink, and that upset him. If he hadn't been upset, he might have gone to the book and author lunch afterward. Since he was upset, he went up to his room in a huff and decided to take a shower and cool off, and I suppose fell. So that makes it all my fault, in a way. If that's the way it was, what can I do about it? You can help me show myself that I'm wrong. That there may have been some other reason he went up to his room, some other reason he was upset, some other reason he slipped. I don't want to have to think I helped kill my friend if I can avoid it, and you can help me. But how? I just want to know everything that happened after the last time I saw him alive last night and you walked off with him." When she hesitated, I said, "I'm not a policeman, Henrietta. I can't make you tell me. I'm just asking you to tell me out of common humanity." "But there's nothing to tell. We went to a TV station and we taped a show." "How did you go? Where? Who did the taping?" "We went by taxi. We picked one up just outside the hotel, and it took us to the studio. It was a morning talk show with what's-her-name." She waved one hand in the air. "Sandra someone." I knew whom she meant. "We taped it all, and that's all." "Did you have to wait long before you started?" 5 or 10 minutes, you know how it is. They always make you wait just so that you know who's boss." "How did Giles take that?" "He just sat there looking straight ahead, puffing out his mustache. I was a little nervous because I had insisted he come, and once or twice he looked at his watch and then at me, but he didn't say a word." "And how did he behave during the taping?" "Like a doll, actually. He was very good. They're going to run it in about 3 weeks to fit in with publication day. If they had any brains, they'll push it ahead now. I wouldn't be surprised, she added bitterly, if they run it tomorrow morning while the convention is still on. Not a chance, I said soothingly. They have commitments, too. What did they talk about? About what you'd expect. She wanted to know about his book and what it was about and whether there would be a movie sale. Then she got on to his writing habits. Since he had said the book dealt partly with the Watergate crisis, she asked whether he didn't think there were fantasy aspects to that. He said surrealism was the word he would use and explained what he meant. He was very good. It was a good show. I'll have to watch, I said. Did she ask about his publishers, anything at all? No, she didn't. Henrietta sounded surprised. Should she have? I don't know, I said ingenuously. I'm just asking because Prism Press are my publishers, too, and I was wondering if they got any of the publicity. Oh, sure. When they mentioned the name of the book at the beginning and end of the program, they mentioned the publisher, too. At no other time, nothing else? Nothing that I can remember. And what happened after the taping was over? Nothing. We went back. It was quite dark by then, and I couldn't see her face clearly in the street lights. Her voice, however, had gone dead. I said, "After you took him to his room, I mean." Her voice gained a sudden edge. "Why do you say I took him to his room?" "You were going to, weren't you? The last thing you said when you left with him was that you would see him safely back to his room." "Oh, I see what you mean," she said with a sudden air of indifference, as though it all meant very little. I went up the elevator with him to his floor. It would have been utterly unconvincing in any case, but now that I had talked to Eunice, I knew exactly where we stood, and she didn't have a chance with me. "Of course," I said, "he asked you into his room." "No," she said feebly. "Henrietta," I said, "be reasonable. He asks every woman into his room." I didn't know that for a fact, but I felt absolutely safe. "And you must have gone in, or you wouldn't be in this state." She didn't answer, and she turned her head away. I'm sure she had started to cry. I said, "I promise you I won't repeat anything you say. You don't have to go into any details. Just let me know roughly what went on." She looked about to see if there was anyone near us. There wasn't. There's a kind of Freemasonry of humanity that keeps anyone not completely outside the pale from coming too near any man and woman engaged in what seems an intimate conversation. She said, "There's nothing I have to be ashamed of, but it's all so unpleasant." I said, "Henrietta, I know Giles better than you think. I have an idea of what he is capable of. He didn't hurt you?" Even though I was doing my best to use words that would keep her calm, it hurt me to use that Victorian pause followed by that Victorian euphemism. "Oh, he didn't," she said, grateful for the euphemism, I'm sure. "He just asked me to come in and tuck him in because I said, joking, you know, after the taping was over, that now I would take him right back to the hotel as I had promised and tuck him in. I laughed because I thought he was joking, too, and said that I hoped he would have a good night's sleep. But he took my wrist in his hand and said, 'Oh, come on in for a while.' Well, I didn't like to make a scene. I couldn't believe he had anything really, you know." She paused in confusion. I said, "You didn't expect him to try to use force on you, you mean?" "Well, I thought he might try to persuade me to come to bed with him." She was suddenly more businesslike, as though she felt it to be beneath her dignity to be caught being too coy. "But I had no doubt he wouldn't succeed. He didn't appeal to me at all, and I have a lover who's quite satisfactory. So I let myself be pulled in, and the door closed behind me, and then I said as coldly as I could, 'Really, I have work to do, Mr. DeVore.' And his voice changed." "His voice changed?" "It became high-pitched and squeaky. Do I have to go on?" "I wish you would, please, just roughly. You don't have to give me every word." "He wanted me to undress him. He called me Mommy."
"What did you do, undress him?"
"I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to start screaming. I didn't want to create a stupid scandal. I thought I'd humor him a little and perhaps calm him down. I mean, I'm not a virgin, and I'm not afraid of men. I took off his jacket, his tie, his shirt, and I helped him off with his shoes and socks. But that was as far as I could go, really. And he said he wanted me to bathe him. I mean, he said, 'Bathe me, Mommy.'
and that was just too much. I just dashed for the door and out.
He didn't try to stop you?
No, he just cried. After I closed the door, I could hear him crying inside like a little boy. So I went down to the bar, and I had a couple of drinks, and thank God I didn't meet anyone I knew. Then I went to my room and took a sleeping pill. I waited a while to let her recover, then I said, "When you took off his clothes, those items of clothing you did take off, that is, what did you do with them?"
"Oh, that was another weird thing. He directed me. He made me put the shoes in the closet with the points inward. He made me hang up his jacket with the buttons facing left, and I had to fold his shirt in some very careful way."
"How did he make you?"
"Well, he told me in his baby voice, in a whiny sort of way. So I did it. I told you I was trying to keep him under control. He wanted me to blow into his socks before folding them. That I wouldn't do, and he got petulant and said he wanted to be bathed, and I ran."
That was it, then. I had what I wanted.
As late as last night, he still insisted on having his clothes folded. Henrietta said, breaking in on my thoughts, "So you have what you wanted?"
"What?"
I looked up quickly. Was another one reading my mind? It was over me that he was upset, not over the missing pens.
"Are you guessing that, or did he tell you that this morning?"
She got down from her seat on the wall.
"Oh, no, I didn't see him this morning. After I left him last night, I never saw him again. I had no intention of seeing him. When I got up this morning, I had breakfast in my room, and I called down at 9:05 and told them I wouldn't be in till after 10. He would be autographing then, and there would be no chance of running into him."
"Then you weren't at the autographing session?"
"Certainly not.
Didn't someone go for him in the morning?"
"I wouldn't know, but it wasn't I. I was through squiring him around."
"Yet I had the distinct impression there had been a woman with him in the morning before 10. Someone had told me so. There was even a name given me."
No use, I drew a blank.
I said, "Look, Henrietta, don't start thinking it was over you that all this happened. It could have been something else altogether. Did Giles say anything at all to you last night that indicated he was disturbed about anything?"
"Not a thing."
"Well, think about it for a while. Did anything happen out of the ordinary? Were you stopped by anyone at any time? Did someone speak to Giles? Did Giles say something puzzling? Did he look funny at any time, I mean, not with respect to his sex games? Is there anything as you think back on last night that puzzled you at the time?"
She said, "Nothing. Not a thing."
Well, I had to accept it. I couldn't beat her into remembering. And at that point, even if there was something to remember, I suspected that she wouldn't, just to be done with it all. In fact, I didn't think I could keep Henrietta there much longer. She showed distinct signs of getting ready to leave. I said hastily, "When did you leave him last night?"
"I didn't look at my watch. It felt something like 11-ish, but I don't know."
"Look, I don't want to talk about it any more, and, you know, it's confidential."
"Absolutely, and thank you."
She turned and hurried down the steps, and I turned in another direction and walked down the street toward the hotel. Scene 19, Shirley Jennifer, 9:10 p.m. What was I to do next? I knew what Giles had done up to possibly 11 p.m. the night before. At 10 a.m. he was autographing. Nobody had said he was late, and it would have been remarked on if he were. What had happened in those 11 hours of night and morning that might account for what happened toward noon? There was a woman with him toward the end of the period. Of that I was certain, even if I couldn't remember what it was that made me certain. The question was, who was she, and had she been with him all night? I tried to put myself in Giles' place. As long as he was with Henrietta, and he was engaged in his game, it would surely never have occurred to him to look at the bureau and note that the package and key were not there. Once she left, did he find another woman with whom to continue the game? And was it not till this morning that he noticed the lack? Or did he go to sleep in frustration after Henrietta left, too much the little boy of his sexual fantasies to notice? Or was it that he did notice, but thought the cloakroom was closed after 11, and was he too frustrated and too little boy to do anything about it? As usual, when I asked myself a series of questions such as these, I had no answer.
I was entering the lobby of the hotel when I heard the cry that I suppose I had been dreading subconsciously ever since lunch.
"Darius, I've been looking for you all day."
I don't think she had, but it was the nice thing to say. "Hello, Shirley," I said dully. "I'm sorry. I've had a terrible day."
"I know. Everyone is talking about it. How awful. And you had to be the one to find it. I suppose that was the reason you never came to my booth when I was signing."
She picked that moment to light a cigarette. She knows I hate it, and I decided that despite her claim to understanding, she was getting back at me for standing her up. I said defensively, "I was spending the time with the cops, and it was no fun."
"Poor baby," she purred.
It was odd how remote and immune I felt. I said, "I feel pretty sick about it, and I guess I'll go home and give myself a chance to recover." I backed away a little. She looked surprised and a little annoyed. "Home?" 1 minute before, I had had no intention of leaving just yet, but now it seemed the thing to do. I could think of no other way of avoiding another night with Shirley, and I had to avoid it. Perhaps after a while I could go back to her, but not that night, not while I was so aware that if it hadn't been for the night before, I wouldn't have been the one to discover Giles' body. If I think about it now, I don't see much sense in my attitude, but at the time it was different. It made more sense to me than anything else that had happened the entire day. "I better do that, Shirley. I'm worn out with the afternoon I've had." I managed a yawn and suddenly found it wasn't difficult. "Will you be here tomorrow?" She looked indifferent. "I don't know." "I'll be here. Maybe I'll see you." And I about-faced and walked out of the hotel. 10 hours earlier, I would have been willing to bet 100 to 8 more that I would spend another night with Shirley, but even very short odds went on occasion. Now I made a bet at the same odds, 100 to 8, that she'd never speak to me again. I won't lie to you. I was sorry about that. Damned sorry. I walked home. It was a healthy walk to the park and then along its long side, but I wasn't in a hurry to try to make it to bed. I kept thinking, with my mind going around in the same circles and ending nowhere. When I found myself in my apartment with the door locks clicked shut behind me, all three of them, and with my typewriter gazing reproachfully at me through the door to the bedroom, as it always seems to do when it is neatly covered and has been unused for longer than 2 days, I couldn't remember the walk from the hotel at all. It was a more than a mile walk, and I couldn't remember a step of it. My passage from hotel to apartment might have been by instantaneous mass transference, like something out of Asimov's silly science fiction stories. Footnote 1. As I recall, I merely thought of science fiction stories generally at this point. You can depend on Asimov to put himself in here as though he were the only writer of science fiction stories the world had ever seen. Darius Just. Footnote 2. One of my better stories, It's Such a Beautiful Day, which you'll find in my book Nightfall and Other Stories, has a plot involving mass transference. Since Darius, after some tedious cross-examination, admitted he had read that story, I maintain that my interpretation here is as close to the truth as need be. Isaac Asimov. It was only about 10:30, too early to go to bed, really, and yet I did not want to stay awake. I went through the preparations for bed, washing my teeth and all the rest of it, half in the hope that it would wake me, but it didn't. Of course, it was possible that going to bed early, I might wake up at 3 a.m. with all my sleep done. I thought of Henrietta taking a sleeping pill, and while I disapprove of that, I would have taken one if there had been such a thing in the house. I put out the light, got into bed, and left the window open so I could hear the hypnotic sounds of traffic and city life seeping upward from 12 floors below. It's hypnotic to those bred in the city, that is. Just before I went to sleep, there was one last thought I had. Isaac Asimov had been the second author at the autographing session. He might have seen Giles come in with somebody. What's more, Asimov was slated to be on some panel the next morning, 11 a.m., I thought. I'd look it up in the morning. It was something I had thought might be interesting anyway. And I slept.